The following program is a sports handicapping show. That's right, we will be discussing sports betting and all kinds of other gambling stuff, including game predictions. As you know, not every bet will win, but we do our best. Feel free to use this information at your own risk, and remember, wager wisely, folks.
Broadcasting from the Vegas Video Network studios, live from the Las Vegas Strip, Covers.com presents Vegas Sports Day. And now from the sports betting capital of the world, here are your hosts, Teddy and the Professor.
It's Wednesday in a beautiful, sunny Las Vegas. You're watching Vegas Sports Day. I'll be your host, Dave Malinsky, today. Same chair, slightly different role. Teddy Covers out with his family for hopefully a very happy Thanksgiving. Joining us today, Covers expert, longtime Vegas handicapper, and all-around good guy, Scott Spreitzer. Coming up today, is there a matchup in Maui that's going to have us making a beeline to the betting windows? We're going to talk about one defense that's been a rambling wreck against this week's opponent. And today we've got so many games to talk about that our pace is going to be like a bat out of hell. Give it a chance. That one's going to connect. Okay, Scott, you're 0 for 1 so far today. You didn't bring donuts. And this is going to be the sugarless, carbless version of Vegas Sports Day. Maybe good heading into what we're going to feast on tomorrow. But how about a first take from the Tuesday night basketball action?
My first take is things Teddy should have told me before I came onto the set of Vegas Sports Day, like bring donuts. My second take, Dave, by the way, happens to go to Tuesday night basketball. The Missouri-California game had my interest from start to finish, and not because it was any such a big nail-biter, so to speak, but because of how dominant this Missouri Tigers team happens to be this year. You know, give Mike Anderson a ton of credit for building this program the way he did, and then taking the job at Arkansas because he wanted it so badly to go back to his roots because he knew what he had in place at Columbia. Now, I remember when Frank Haith got the job for Missouri when Anderson left, and a lot of the Tiger fans, their reaction was, huh? Because Frank Haith did not come in with these great credentials. But Haith does bring something to the mix with this Missouri Tiger team this year, folks. If you remember under Mike Anderson, they ran that 40 minutes of hell, basically, to, for lack of a better term. And what they did was they pressed up and down the court from the opening tip almost till the final gun. And we saw the Missouri Tigers the last couple of years, despite all their athleticism, getting a little bit tired in the second half of games, and it really affected them when they left Columbia and had to play on the road. What Frank Haith is going to do, and we saw it again last night, we've seen him do it twice so far this season, they did it also against the Irish when they blew Notre Dame off the court, is he is picking and choosing his spots to press with this incredibly quick and athletic Missouri team. And so what's happening now is they are better in their half-court offensive sets because they are not pressing up and down the floor. And that means this team is going to be fresher on the road than they have been in the last couple of editions, and it's going to make this team a better squad. I do this little article on Covers each and every week where we basically break down the top 25 in college football and college basketball into the most overrated top 25 team, the most underrated top 25 team, and a team that's unranked that I feel should be in the top 25. And we're going to switch back to college basketball in a few weeks. I had two teams going into Tuesday night that I felt fit the underrated team slot, and that was both California and Missouri. Folks, I still believe California going into last night's game at 18th is an underrated basketball team. That shows you how much I like this Missouri team. Dave, I'm telling you right now, this is a team with Final Four potential, and they're probably playing the second best basketball in the college game right now behind North Carolina. What did you see from Tuesday's card?
Actually, something a whole lot different. We've been looking forward to this day for quite some time. It was our chance to say Vegas Sports Day. Now, if you've been following this from day one, you notice that's done a little bit differently than our friend Teddy does it. In fact, one of the things that's going to be really interesting, there's a woman who lives in an apartment building across the street. For the first time in weeks, her dog will not have whistled right at 11 o'clock. But we thought about this for a long time. How do you say it? And it took us back memory lane a little bit. So think about the way it flows off the tongue and think about Sports Day. This is going to probably take you back maybe to the third girl you dated, maybe the second, but probably not the first. And you remember that sort of leading kiss that you would give when you want to see if you can take it a little further, but you're not sure. Lead and read. That little bit extra on the peck where you're not only trying to send a message, but you're trying to read and see what the message is from the other side to see if you can take that extra base. Straight out of paradise by the dashboard light. And yeah, you'll have plenty of turkey tomorrow, meatloaf for today, or if Teddy was here, maybe night moves. And yeah, for you younger guys, go Google it on the break. You'll find them. Those lead and read moments of those wonderful early passions. Well, as you get older, the mysteries change a little bit. We find answers to questions we realize were just trivial when we were younger. And we also find that the ones we don't have answers to yet, we're not likely to find those answers. Life's complexities. One of the mysteries, though, that does change over time is those days now when you leave the batting box already knowing that it's out of the park and you could take your time rounding the bases. Of course, there's a trade-off with that as the years go by. While you enjoy that moment, you also know you're just not going to be legging out as many triples as you used to. And you finally get around to changing that light in the bathroom vanity mirror. Instead of hearing Phil Rizzuto in the background, you realize you are Phil Rizzuto. And sometimes you actually don't mind that intentional walk, so you can just go to first base and stand there for a little while. So as we all get ready to give thanks for the things that we're grateful for through the years, and we hope you're all with special people that you can do that tomorrow, say sports day, right around that time that grace has been done. Think back to those early memories. Dina, wherever you are, I hope it's worked out well for you. And if your wife or significant other wonders why you have that sly smile on your face, just say, look, the Packers covered. I've got money in my pocket. But if the name of this show is Sports Day, you probably want us to talk about sports. And we will. Let's go to Market Watch right now and get on top of some things that matter for this week's college football games. Yesterday's show, we talked about the conference races. Who needed to beat who in terms of getting into the conference championship games? We promise another list today. These are teams that are not eligible for a bowl yet, but by winning this week, become eligible. So let's take this list from the top. We're going to go in alphabetical order. We're going to start with the East Carolina Marshall winner. That's a winner-take-all to be bowl eligible. Eastern Michigan, Hawaii, who may need to win twice. And, of course, if you're thinking about Hawaii, you might want to see who their own players have bet on first. We'll get back to that one on Friday. We're being a little silly. There's no meat between the bread on that. But Hawaii would need to win twice. Kent State and also Mississippi State.
Any time, Dave, that UNLV blows a team out by 40 points, there ought to be a thought of an investigation. So, you know, there you go. But now you know why we call him the Jim Steinem of Vegas Sports Day. And he forgot to tell you one big piece of advice at the end of Dave's monologue there. And that is basically when she says, are you going to love me forever? Are you going to make me your wife? You run like a bat out of hell. So anyway, Purdue is another team that has to win this week. How about Tennessee, Texas Tech, Utah State, UTEP, Vanderbilt? All of these teams have to win this week to become bowl eligible, Dave.
Okay, now let's talk about one of the keys. You think, okay, they need to win to be bowl eligible. We want to bet on these teams. Maybe not so fast. There's a reason why you're not bowl eligible yet. You haven't won enough games. You're not very good. So, Scott, here comes the question. If you're not that good, okay, LSU goes to Alabama. Big game. They step up to it because A teams do that. These C-minus teams, when the pressure's on, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it can be a bad thing, and mainly because when you're looking at the way these teams got to the position they're in, I mean, you look at offenses that are really struggling. Tennessee has been terrible on the offensive side of the football for most of the second half of the season. That added pressure to have to win these football games to become bowl eligible, I think maybe tightens up the sphincter, so to speak, for lack of a better term. Sorry about that, but they gave me a hard time for no donuts all throughout the morning. But the bottom line is, I think that teams like that, like Purdue, who have struggled a little bit down the stretch, losing 3 out of 4 games, they're going to be a little bit tight going into this game, but it is the old oaken bucket. And what you got to also factor in, as this late in the season, there are also situations situations where teams are playing their biggest rival, and that gets factored in the mix also. So you got an Indiana team, for instance, playing Purdue. Indiana has not yet won in Big Ten play. They're 0-7. They've scored a grand total of 122 points in their seven conference games. But they're going to be loose and fancy-free in this game against the Purdue Boilermakers, and they would like nothing better than to keep their chief rival from making it to a bowl game. So when you factor those into the mix, and then you've got a Purdue team that knows they absolutely positively have to win to get that bowl invitation, it does put a little bit of extra pressure, I think, on that team, and especially on the offensive side of the football.
But for today, we're going to take all the pressure off of you. We're going to deliver the winners later in Money Time. Remember, this show is all about you. Your emails have been very important to us. Keep them coming. sportsday@covers.com. You can follow us on Twitter. That's @VegasSportsDay. And get into the posting forums. covers.com. Click on forums. You'll find active discussions going on during the show. Coming up next, Scott's parents always wanted him to be a doctor. Now he gets to play one in the postmortem.
Are you looking for the latest odds, the fastest scores, the most important trends, and the best matchups and stats? Are you looking for the key late-breaking information that can make you a winner? Well, covers.com has the answer. The world's largest sports betting community gives you a front-row seat in the heart of the action, from the opening lines to the final scores. If you want to stay ahead of the game, Covers covers the numbers.
Oh, hello there. My name is Brandon Gooch Hahn, host of Awkward Silence 2.1. And when I'm not living vicariously through Chris Phillips, I'm on VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Okay, guys, time to scrub up. Let's get those surgical gowns on. It's time for the postmortem, where we take you deep inside the game to show you things you should have seen, but probably didn't.
Well, I'll tell you what, in the postmortem segment, you've heard Teddy and Dave talking about Senior Day, and that's basically what we have here. And Teddy said on yesterday's show, Senior Day, Senior Bowl doesn't necessarily reference what's going on in the state of Alabama after the season in all-star college football. But instead, it has to do with teams matching up and how they've done over a series of time. And for instance, Georgia, Georgia Tech, big rivalry renewing this week in Atlanta, Georgia. And what we've got here are two teams that have played each other, obviously, each of the last four seasons. Paul Johnson, since he's been at Georgia Tech, did win that first game against Mark Richt and the Georgia Bulldogs. But since then, Georgia has come back to take the last couple of the games. However, you've seen Georgia Tech piling up a ton of points going up against this Georgia Bulldog defense. Now, one of the reasons is that obviously, playing in the SEC, the Georgia Bulldogs are taking on more conservative brand offenses, more almost pro set or old traditional pro set offenses than they face when they take on a Georgia Tech team that runs that option under Georgia Tech as well as anybody in the nation has in the last 20 years. And Dave, what I want to know is, can this Georgia Bulldog squad find the sweet elixir to shut down Paul Johnson's option?
So it's been fascinating about this series. You would think you've got SEC athletes on defense. You should be able to handle this sort of attack. You've got the speed. All you have to do is put the right pieces in the right places. So we can excuse Mark Richt and his defensive coaches the first time around against Georgia Tech. It was an ugly loss, 45-42 in Athens, the most points Georgia's given up at home in a long time. Second year, Georgia wins. They still don't stop the option. Now you get to the third year. Doesn't just mean that the coaches have had their third opportunity. Now a lot of these players have had their third opportunity. Yeah, they win the game, but they don't cover the spread as a double-digit favorite. They allow over 500 yards of offense and over 400 rushing yards. So when we tally it up, what do we find? In 3 years against this defense, Paul Johnson's offense has rushed for 1,088 yards at 5.7 yards per carry. Think about how significant that is. That's 362.7 yards per game. That's the highest Georgia Tech has averaged against any opponent. They've rushed for more yards against Georgia than they have against Duke. What does that tell us? We bring this up for two reasons. One, Richt and his staff have not figured this out yet. And if you haven't figured it out on the second look or the third look, you might be confused on the fourth, but pay particular attention this week. Georgia's in the SEC championship game. They will know when they take the field who they're playing, most likely an undefeated LSU. If you're Mark Richt, do you even try to game plan for Georgia Tech, knowing that that might take your defense out of rhythm just a little bit for a much bigger challenge on deck? Or do you just go out there and play it straight up and hope that maybe this time the players on their own could figure it out? What a matchup Thursday night the NFL has for their draw. They got lucky with this one. San Francisco not only coming in at 9-1 against the Ravens, but Harbaugh versus Harbaugh. Now, if we had said this on week one, San Francisco coming into Thanksgiving night 9-1, boy, there would have been a lot of surprise. And when we go through the numbers, we're still kind of confused by this. Okay, you're 9-1. So let's break it down. Well, you've been outgained by your opponents. You've gained 5.3 yards per play. You've given up 5.2. Okay, that looks like 5-5, doesn't it? Now we do see that one magical column. Turnovers. They are plus 16 over those 10 games. And you know what? A plus 16, a 1.6 per game, that can turn 500 stats, maybe not into a 9-1, but at least an 8-2 or a 7-3. So is that the magic number when we break down how the 49ers got to be where they are? Or is there something inside that 5.3, 5.2 conundrum that might be overlooked by people who don't dig deep into what we do in the postmortem?
I believe so, that 5.3, 5.2 thing, Dave, because what you got here is a San Francisco 49er football team that looks to get out in front early and then kind of sit on the lead. They're not going to give Alex Smith a lot of opportunities to make costly mistakes. So because you see this team getting out to leads, running the football, you're going to see them outgaining teams on the ground, but likely getting outgained through the air. And that's the way the stats have broken down. They've actually outgained their opponents by over 100 yards, but they've been outgained through the air by over 100 yards. But again, it has to do with getting out in front early and then making sure that you don't put the onus of the offense or the game on your quarterback, so you keep him, his mistake possibilities or his potential at a minimum. So as far as this game is concerned, when I start breaking this down, Dave talked about turnovers and the plus 16 turnover margin for the San Francisco 49ers. You saw that little great graphic above Dave's shoulder. Man, that was on a fumble, on a punt, and you saw six or seven San Francisco 49er players covering that ball, knocking each other out of the way to get to the pigskin. You didn't see an opponent, one single member of the opposition, and that's what San Francisco does. They are ball hawks. They're going after the ball on defense. Now, part of recovering or forcing turnovers on the defensive side of the ball and being able to pounce on them after the ball gets loose, there's a little bit of luck involved with that. But offensively, I mean, break it down, and here is what Harbaugh has done for his quarterback, Alex Smith, who had no real NFL success before this season. Check out the numbers. On first down, San Francisco this season has a better passing completion percentage than any team in the NFL on first down. Alex Smith has completed over 70% of his first down passes this season. On third down, Alex Smith and the Niners have thrown fewer passes than any other team in the NFL. So what this means is they're throwing on running downs, on first down, on early situations to try to make those third down situations more manageable. And what it's done for the San Francisco 49ers has limited the potential for Alex Smith and his offensive unit to make costly mistakes. So we've seen a great game management not have to be done by the quarterback, but by the offensive coaching staff, and they've done a fantastic job, Dave, at how they've been able to handle this. And you've seen a team, you mentioned, you know, a lot of people are talking about whether San Francisco is a real legitimate 9-1 team, or are they closer to 5-5? I'm going to break in the middle here and say they're probably more like a 7-3 football team when you break it down, because again, those turnovers that they get on the defensive side of the football, it's about 60-40, with 60 being luck side, because once you force that fumble or a ball gets tipped, you need a little good fortune to be able to pounce on that football or to come up at the interception. But offensively, again, Harbaugh's doing a great job at limiting his quarterback's potential to make costly mistakes.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the other Harbaugh in our Inside the Numbers segment. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Let me know when I'm live. Hi, everybody. This is Bridget Magnus of Getting Real Estate in Vegas, and you are watching the Vegas Video Network.
Livestream is your premier place to watch live events on the web, mobile devices, and connected TVs. See new events daily or broadcast your own at livestream.com. Livestream. Be there.
Okay, guys, we're going to go inside the numbers in a minute, but first, a little bit shorter in the mailbox today because we got so many games to go through, but one that is topical and worth getting into, and this comes from Bo. Now, originally, this was a reference to a play of the day we'd made on NC State a couple of nights ago, but it applies through all football and basketball games. He said, hey, guys, NC State, is it a better idea to take plus 115 on the money line or to take plus 2.5 minus $1.10? I always take the money line, signed Bo. Scott, your take, money line, point spread.
Well, what we have going on for us, Dave, right now, and a lot of people have this in our business, is kind of a chart to show you the equivalency between, you know, the money line and how it breaks down against the point spread. And you've got to look at that, I think, when you're handicapping these short underdogs. But for me, and I'm a matchup guy at heart, I've incorporated situationals and angles and things of that nature as I've moved on throughout the 20 years of doing this. But I want to know what coaches do in close games. And if you're talking about an underdog of 3.5, 4, or 5 points, and you're looking at a coach who doesn't win the big games, who loses the close games, when there are close spreads involved, then obviously you want to take the points almost every time. But if you've got a coach who knows how to win those tight, close ball games, you know, in the closing minutes of games as a short underdog, then obviously you might even want to break it up to a percentage where you play a small percentage on the money line and a bigger portion of your bet against the spread. At least that's the way I look at it from my perspective.
One of the things we always want to do is we do our little extra charting of straight up and point spread. So many times people say, well, they're so-and-so against the spread. Make sure you do that little bit of straight up research. And that's one of the things we're going to tie in today. In our Inside the Numbers segment, let's talk about how we're going to chart not only straight up, but also against the spread for a guy that we like an awful lot. It's Harbaugh versus Harbaugh tomorrow. But John at Baltimore has not been an easy guy to beat. He's taken care of his home turf. When we go inside the numbers for Wednesday, let's take a look at just how dynamic the Ravens have been at home under John Harbaugh. 29 games so far, a 24-5 straight up record. Make sure you note that off to the side when you talk about these money line elements, but also getting some convincing wins. 18-10-1 against the spread in those games. It's been quite a challenge to take on John Harbaugh and the Ravens on their field. And when we get into our money line segment later, we're going to talk about just how much of a challenge that's been. But coming up next, it's Money Time NCAA edition. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Traditional media believes that after about 3 minutes, you'll tune out. Most Vegas media companies think if it doesn't jiggle, you won't tune in. At the Vegas Video Network, we think both are wrong. The Vegas Video Network is the first and only live online broadcast network that specializes in insider news and expert views about Vegas. We combine great storytelling with the ability to watch when and where you want, on your computer, mobile device, or television. Discover the real Las Vegas. Visit VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Okay, guys, you know what time it is. It's only money time today. You can skip all the rest of the M&Ms. Put them in your holiday bowl. It's money time. And today, money time is brought to you by Covers. Remember that for all the information you need in every sport, Covers covers the numbers. We're going to start this evening out in Maui. Michigan-UCLA matchup. Game that's gone back and forth in the marketplace. When we came on the air, Michigan back down to a -6-point favorite over UCLA. We saw a little bit of a comeback from UCLA last night that we think might have been misinterpreted. This team has been off to a disastrous start to the season. Double-figure losses in LA to the type of teams they would usually walk over. Loyola Marymount, Middle Tennessee, they allowed those teams to shoot over 50%. But there was a comeback happening against Kansas that we think might have fooled the market. So UCLA's down at 17 at halftime. They hit 5 3-pointers in a row, makes it look like they're back in the game. And then when we look up, they're down by 16 again. Scott, was it a real comeback or just a roll of the dice to hit a few long-range shots at the right time?
We weren't talking last night, but you would think we were because I saw the same thing. And here's what's scary about what's going on right now in Westwood for Ben Howland, who's been a terrific coach throughout most of his career. I tell you what, this team seems to be running away from their coach right now. Reeves Nelson, of course, suspended from the team. You look at the bench last night in the first half against the Kansas Jayhawks, and I'm talking early on, they looked like they didn't want to be there. They looked like they were disinterested in what was happening on the court. There was even a comment made just 3 minutes into the game by one of the announcers that said, Can UCLA really be worn out 3 minutes into a basketball game? That's how bad they looked. They weren't running any sets on the offensive side of the court. Now, listen, I know Kansas is one of the best in the nation at running side to side as far as their offensive scheming is concerned when they have the basketball, and they do have great athletes, obviously, again, for Bill Self. But the bottom line was, is this UCLA team, Dave, man, they were not in the game between the years. There is a lot of million-dollar talent on this UCLA squad, but there are a whole lot of 10-cent heads, and those 10-cent heads have overtaken the million-dollar talent. So I agree with you completely on this basketball game. That second half run was a bunch of jump shot Charlies from the three-point line. There weren't a lot of offensive sets. Kansas relaxed a little bit defensively, and UCLA made it look closer than it actually was. If Kansas stayed focused and UCLA didn't hit some fortunate three-pointers, that could have been a 25 to 30-point blowout win by the Kansas Jayhawks.
So we want to have a little bit of Michigan, you know, in our pockets this evening, particularly because we like Trey Burke. If there was a question that Wolverines had coming into this season, were they going to get the kind of point guard play they need to make the rest of the offense go? Boy, did Trey Burke showcase himself last night against a fundamentally sound Duke defense. 17 points, 9 assists, only 3 turnovers. We were going to try to look up the last time someone said 9 assists against a Mike Krzyzewski defense. We realized that was going to take us a while. It doesn't happen very often. So let's transition that thought now to the nightcap in Maui, one of the best championship games in quite some time. Kansas against Duke. Again, money that's gone both ways in the markets. We're seeing Duke down around 4.5 right now. Was as high as 5.5 earlier, was as low as 3 to open the day. Duke going for win number 15 in a row in this tournament. This is the fifth trip they've made under Krzyzewski, 14-0. They've taken the trophy home the first 4 times. Scott, what about tonight?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm looking at in this particular basketball game, Dave. First of all, I like that point spread being around 4.5 or 5 if you happen to like the Duke Blue Devils in this contest. But what they're going to attempt to do, the Kansas Jayhawks, is get that ball back inside. They've got to get it into Robinson, and if they're unable to do it, then they're going to struggle in this basketball game. And Duke, as you've seen already, they own the type of bodies that can deny in the paint on the defensive side of the court. Now, offensively, they're going to continue to put up those three-pointers. The reason Duke was able to jump out to that big lead against the Michigan Wolverines last night was that the 1-3-1 matchup that Michigan employs on the defensive end was simply no distraction for what Duke wants to do, and that's because they've got big bodies who can take the three besides outstanding shooters like Seth Curry. So they can do that, but they can also run those wide sets, and on wide sets, they do a great job of screening against the defense, and that leaves nobody to double up inside when they run those backcourt or those backdoor screens and layups, and they get a lot of easy shots and high percentage makes. All they have to do to cover these kind of spreads, though, is start making more free throws. Talking about the Duke Blue Devils, which sounds kind of odd because when you're thinking about Coach K, you're thinking about attention to detail. Now, they came up a bucket short, of course, last night. Well, they could have covered the spread depending on when you got it, but they came up a bucket short in their previous game against the number when they allowed a late layup to be made on the other end. So I do think this line has been adjusted enough. It's being held down a little bit to where the Duke Blue Devils can win this game by about 8 to 10 points and get the cover. And again, if you're the Kansas Jayhawks, you've got to get guys like Taylor and Johnson involved. You've got to kick the ball inside to Robinson and hope he throws the ball out when he's double-teamed to find the open man. I just think Duke is way too detail-oriented on the defensive side of the court to allow this to happen throughout the game. Maybe it happens in the first half, but halftime adjustments come and Duke pulls away from this team.
I think the conundrum we're going to see with Duke all year is how good can this backcourt play defense? You know, they've got the ability to score because they don't just shoot three-pointers. They shoot them beyond the arc several feet. They've got incredible range when you talk about Curry and Dawkins. 11 out of 21 triples last night. Why is that significant? Well, this is one of these little subtle things you want to look at in tournaments. You're shooting at the same rims. You're getting a comfort zone in that particular gym. Now it's the third game in 3 days. They're going to be pretty comfortable there. Our question about Duke, the defense on the perimeter. Michigan last night shoots 49.2%, only turns the ball over 9 times. Duke exerts much less defensive pressure than we're used to seeing in the past. Could this be one of these late scramble games, or if it's close, you get some fouls, you get some good execution, you steal some sneaky points, maybe to play our way into an over?
Let me throw something at you about what you were saying about Duke not being as much of a pressure defensive team as they have been in the past. And I wonder, because there is so much youth in the backcourt for this basketball team, and of course I'm talking about Doc Rivers' kid, who's, you know, in his first year with the Duke Blue Devils and trying to make his mark with his team early on. This will be their seventh game in 12 days. Now everybody in Maui's playing their third game in 3 days, but I wonder if that had something to do with what was going on last night, not to mention they had built that big early lead and really paid attention to detail, battling a 1-3-1 zone that they don't normally see. So I kind of was thinking, Dave, that maybe that was part of what we saw last night. They were so in tune to what they had to do against that 1-3-1 zone on the offensive end, and then, of course, playing all these games in such a short time span, that maybe they were a little bit weary, and that could catch up to them in the second half.
It's going to be an issue for Duke well into the season. This is about a seven-man rotation, so you have some limitations. Let's talk about rotations now by switching to football. Tomorrow night, big matchup in College Station, Texas A&M, an 8-point favorite, total around 53.5 now over Texas, and player rotation becomes a big issue. On an Insider Six-Pack earlier this week, we talked about the Texas A&M running back situation. Christine Michael, who was the leading rusher for the team at the time he was injured, gone for the season. Now some questions about Cyrus Gray. He's got a hairline fracture in his left shoulder. Sounds like you're not going to play if that's your issue, but they won't officially rule him out yet. Is this just a case of playing around a little bit with the heads of the Texas defensive coaches, trying to keep them guessing a bit? We're not sure. Our thought is, you know what, if you got that type of injury, no matter how big the opponent is, you don't risk a player. But here's the problem for A&M. When you take Michael and Gray away, there's not a running back on that roster who has 100 yards all season. Puts a little bit too much pressure on a passing game going into a good defense.
I think the next two running backs after Gray and after McNeil, or Michael, I should say, have a combined 28 or 29 carries between the two of them. So it's going to be a situation where if Gray is not able to go because of that hairline fracture, this team could be limited on the offensive side of the football when it comes to running the ball. But they're pretty dynamic on the offensive side of the ball anyway. Listen, here's what I look at when I'm going into this contest, this final battle possibly for these two teams to go matched up against each other for quite some time, with A&M moving on to the SEC. You know, some 30 or 31 years ago, back in my formative years, growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, we were in a lot of trouble on American radio. We were somewhere between...
You were Omaha, Nebraska?
Yes, I am,
so
from Omaha, Nebraska.
Should we have done, like, maybe Jack and Diane? Instead of Paradise by the Dashboard Light?
You could have run that little ditty.
Okay.
But I'm bummed. But anyway, you know, when I'm looking at this game, we were in a world of hurt when it came to American radio, because we were stuck 31, 32 years ago, give or take a year or two, somewhere between staying alive and I want a new drug. It was ugly. But across the pond, there was some good stuff happening. I almost said another S word there. But anyway, there was some good stuff happening across the pond, and there happened to be a British subject by the name of Reckless Eric, who had a thick Cockney accent and a punk attitude, and he pinned a lyric, and it said, "There's only one destination to your final taxi." Now, I know my Cockney accent sounds a little bit like Katharine Hepburn with too much male testosterone, but I had to do it anyway. But here's the situation. I have ever since, over the last 20 years, thought of these final week's games for some coaches as their final taxi, and there's only one destination, and that's the exit door if you lose some of these games. Now, Mack Brown is going to be okay for at least another season. After last year, it was get rid of your assistants, because we're not settling for teams that don't make bowl games in Austin, Texas, with all this money we have pouring into the program. He might get another year or two, and that's going to be it, despite how much success he's had. But if I'm the AD at A&M, I am telling Mike Sherman, he's got a choice. Either get rid of defensive coordinator Tim DeRuyter, who has messed this thing up this year, or you're gone. You've got a choice. You will either take your final taxi this week or DeRuyter here. And here's why I come to that conclusion. Because when DeRuyter had his first season as the A&M defensive coordinator, they played pretty well last year. In the offseason, he started interviewing for head coaching jobs, including the vacated job at Tulsa. Obviously didn't get it. He comes back. 8 returning starters to this A&M defense, and they have been horrible. They were stuck around dead last in college football against the pass for most of this season until they took on the hapless Kansas Jayhawks last week. So I'm going to tell you right now, if I'm the AD at A&M, I say one thing to Sherman. It's either you or DeRuyter or both. It's your choice. Are you taking your final taxi, or is your defensive coordinator?
So you can probably see where we're going to go with this one if you've been following along. We did a postmortem on Texas A&M 2 weeks ago. Talked about the fact that, you know, they were rated number 7 and number 8 in the 2 preseason polls. And now you read all these articles. Why was A&M such a disappointment? Well, they weren't. The polls were wrong. A&M was not number 7 or number 8. They haven't had a disappointing season. That's just simply who they are. But that's not the way things are done in the modern media. You don't have an article saying, how did the pollster screw Texas A&M's projection up so badly? That's all good for us. Anti-A&M has been good for our pockets over a big part of this season, and it looks like it will be again here. And let's talk about that defense, because we have what we call real numbers, and I'll tell you why in a moment. Look at the overall. A&M, number 76 in yards allowed, number 79 in points allowed. Texas, number 10 in yards, number 26 in points. See that gap? We call them real numbers because they've got 6 common opponents. So this is not comparing apples to oranges here. This is apples to apples. Texas has been the better defensive team. So where is that going to take us? Jacob, it's time for a graphic here. Our NCAA play of the day, give us the better defensive team, give us the fresher running back rotation, give us the Texas Longhorns to be very live to possibly win this game outright, but to at worst stay comfortably under that +8. When we come back, money time is going to shift to one of the best Thanksgiving days on the NFL gridirons in our betting lifetime. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
I'm Courtney Leone. This is Vegas Video Network. You want me to mention awkward silence? Let's do that then. Okay. Never been on set here before. I'm always out live on location for Awkward Silence 2.1. I'm Courtney Leone, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network. Good, better.
NFL edition. Let's go to Detroit. Possibly the biggest game in Detroit in our betting lifetime. Maybe the biggest game in Detroit since that memorable Packers-Lions back in the mid-60s when the Packers came in undefeated but didn't leave that way. Scott, they're coming in undefeated tomorrow. Will they go home the same?
Quarterback situation in 1962, I believe it was much worse than it is now for the Detroit Lions, and they still won the football game, as you just mentioned, and Green Bay went on, though, to have a great season, a one loss or two loss season in 1962. But yeah, when you look at this game and I try to break it down, I had Carolina last week against Detroit, and we were feeling pretty good, by the way, when the Panthers got up to that 24-7 lead and Cam Newton was seemingly doing whatever he wanted to that Lions defense. And you know, when you watch that front four for the Lions, who were able to generate a pass rush from their base 43, and guys like Fairley when he's healthy and Ndamukong Suh dominate quarterbacks, it allows their back seven to do what they are there to do, what they're paid for, and that is to cover wide receivers and to watch out for running backs out of the backfield. They don't have to pay attention to helping out too much against the run or in the pass rush. So it really frees up this defense. But I'm going to tell you something. Last week, there was one play that happened in that Carolina-Detroit game that allowed Detroit to sneak back into it when Carolina could have kind of put them away, and it might have saved the Detroit Lions season, and it was nothing they did. Carolina had the ball third down and about 10 inside their own 20-yard line. Detroit was just starting to make a mild comeback at the time. If Carolina goes down and even kicks a field goal, they probably win that football game. Cam Newton makes a great read, makes a fantastic pass, hits Steve Smith squarely in the hands at about the 40-yard line for about a 25-yard gain, and it goes right through one of the most reliable pair of hands in the NFL over the past decade. And what it did is they had to punt the ball the next time out. Detroit got good field position. They scored on the ensuing drive, and the rest is history as they piled up 49 points. Matthew Stafford, somewhere in the mix, found his mojo again. He started making the right reads and the right passes and stopped forcing things. And that's what he's going to have to do, Dave, against these Green Bay Packers. As far as Green Bay is concerned, a couple of years ago, they got blasted. It was either a Sunday night or Monday night game, and it was in December, and it was the game that really turned things around for the Packers. It was the year before the Super Bowl. They go out and they hire Dom Capers to shore up a defense that got blasted for 50 points by the Saints in primetime. Capers did a great job of having his defense manage things last year when Green Bay was beset by injuries all season long on the offensive side of the football. But we've seen Capers' defense have some leaks, and they're having to try to plug some leaks now. Now, Detroit's able to run the football even without Javid Best for the most part, and Green Bay will give up chunks of yardage on the ground. They're good at picking off passes. They're not real great at getting to the quarterback all the time against the top teams on their slate, and they also have a rough time against the run. So what I think you're going to see here is the Lions are going to have to play a little bit more conservative early on in this game. Run the football against a susceptible run defense and then try to play your game through the air. So for me, Dave, I think you've got a chance at seeing a lower scoring game than the odds makers have projected. And I know that's dangerous when you're talking about the Green Bay Packers or the New England Patriots when you're talking about playing unders. But for me, that would be the way to go for the type of schematics that I think Detroit's going to have to come on the offensive side to have a chance to win this football game.
And the one thing we did see Detroit do, run the ball a little bit against Carolina, actually get a little bit of balance back into their offense, and that window is open. When you look at the Packers' statistics, you've got to be a little bit careful with them, because so many times when a team's winning all their games, you'll give up a lot of yards and say, well, they give it up because they've got big leads. That actually hasn't been the case. The Packers are what we would call a 45-75. That means you're allowing over 4.5 per rush and over 7.5 per pass. That's a dangerous combination. It means that you're not actually making stops anywhere, regardless of the game situation. If you saw Green Bay against Tampa last Sunday, you saw Tampa consistently move the ball through the course of the game, even though the Packers had the crowd behind them. So how can a team playing that poorly on defense be where they are in the standings? We've done an Inside the Numbers segment on Aaron Rodgers 2 weeks ago and talked about how their passing game isn't just the best in the NFL, but it's so far gapped out that it's truly a historical level. We're still talking about 9.7 yards per pass this late into the season. Absolutely unheard of, more than one full yard more per passing attempt than anyone else in the league. Teams do not distance themselves that much. So that becomes a conundrum in this game. For Detroit, is the pass rush enough? Because if it isn't, you've got pretty average coverage people. You're going to have to live and die off of that. Now, it's worked so far. 15 interceptions by the Lions, only 10 touchdown passes. That's a great ratio. Usually when we see that, we like the secondary, but we don't. We like the pass rush. The problem is if you don't get to Rodgers, look at how many weapons. Five different receivers have at least 20 catches and at least 14 yards per reception. They get the ball pretty far down the field. So that's going to be the key matchup here. Can they get to Rodgers enough to throw him out of rhythm? Because if he gets time on perfect playing conditions on a fast service, the ball's going to get down the field pretty quickly. Now let's go to Dallas. The Cowboys, 7. Total running around 44 against a Miami team that all of a sudden brings momentum into play. What looked like a dead matchup a few weeks ago, now the Dolphins have won 3 games in a row, but it begs the question, do those last 3 wins actually mean all that much?
You know, when I look at this game, Dave, it's really funny because I'm looking at Miami all of a sudden. If you look at their last 5 games, they've held teams to about 12 points per contest. And when you look at the last 3 games, I think you got to break it down to who they've played, where they've played, and what the situation has been for that opposition. And against Buffalo last week, you want to talk about a misleading final score of 35-8. You know, Miami was outgained in that game. They only gained 242 yards in the contest, and now they're going to have to find an offense under Matt Moore against a pretty good Dallas football team that, as everybody knows, was underrated just a few short weeks ago when Tony Romo was taking all those hits by the media, by the press. He was actually having a pretty good season, except for a couple of maybe miscues or mistakes made between the years. But over the last couple of weeks, Tony Romo has been spot on his game. He has been picking defenses apart, and I think he's going to challenge this Miami defense like they haven't been challenged for quite some time. Let's not forget about some of the offenses that Miami has faced so far, and they've gone up against some pretty bad teams, and we're talking about the Skins, the Chiefs, and their discombobulated set. You're talking about the Buffalo Bills, who only gained 247 yards last week, and things aren't going quite as smoothly for Buffalo over the last few weeks under their quarterback, Fitzpatrick. Here's the bottom line in this particular football game. Dallas is going to put the pedal to the metal on the opposite side of the football, guys, and I think what it's going to do is kind of shock Miami, kind of pop them in the chin, give them the business, so to speak, and what it's going to happen is force Matt Moore to make some plays. And if you remember what happens to the Miami Dolphins on that Monday Night Football game against the New York Jets when the quarterback all of a sudden has to start making plays, it can only be ugly. Yes, I know Reggie Bush has been better as of late, but again, it's been because of the opposition. Not this week. The win streak is over as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, part of what Miami has had the last 3 weeks is what we would call a free ride. Moore has had no pressure situations, able to stay very conservative in their offensive schemes. Well, you don't get a free ride at Dallas because of the way those Ryan blitz packages are going to come after you. Tougher to prepare for that sort of defense on a short practice week. Let's talk about what that short week means a little bit too, because we wanted to break down just how the Cowboys have done now that they annually also play at home on Thanksgiving. We can't really count the Lions because through the years, the Lions have been a bad team. They've drawn small crowds on Thanksgiving Day. They weren't really the type that was going to rise to an occasion. But what happens to a good team when they get the advantage of this setup? Well, Dallas has covered 7 straight years at home on Thanksgiving. 5 of those 7 games were games they also won in double figures. Now, this is an offense that's got an awful lot of weapons. Scott has said Romo's doing a better job of managing the game, using those weapons, and now getting Felix Jones brought back into that rotation. So it looks like if the Cowboy past is prologue here, if we could say, yes, you will play well on Thursday, you can adapt to this, we might see Miami get shattered a little bit. It's been almost a month since Moore has had to take a snap from behind against a quality opponent. Those last 3 wins might not mean anywhere near what they would look like in the standings. Now let's go to the nightcap in Baltimore. Again, they could not have drawn a better scenario here. We're seeing Baltimore, a 3.5-point favorite, total around 38.5 right now. And the first thing that comes into mind here, when we close with Dallas about your preparation for Thursday, for as good as this matchup could be, they've sure given one of the Harbaughs a big edge. How tough is it to go from the West Coast to the East Coast for a Thursday night? Let's break it down so you understand exactly what we're talking about here, because there's been a history of teams from the West Coast faring poorly when they play in the East Coast, not vice versa. Why is that? Think about the time zones and those adjustments in your mind. When you lose 3 hours in the West to East and you lose the travel time, you've actually lost an entire day out of your practice week. If you get up in San Francisco first thing in the morning and you get on a plane to Baltimore, it's dark when you're getting off that plane. Now, it's one thing when you go Sunday to Sunday, and again, teams still fare poorly, but when you have to go from Sunday to Thursday and you lose a full day out of that week, you may not be at your best come kickoff.
I think you hit the key on the head there. That last part you said, Dave, when you said a short week is what basically they're doing. And that's what I look at in this particular football game. And I want to see and think how that short week is going to affect a well-coached football team like the San Francisco 49ers. Back in 2009, after the 2008 season, I got in touch with another handicapper who has about a 30-year database. I call it his Wayback Machine. And I'll tell you what, we decided to break down how teams fared when they went from the West Coast to the East Coast. Straight up, guys, it was almost a wash. It was 261 wins for the West Coast team outright, 257 wins for the East Coast team playing at home outright with a few ties mixed in. Now, the spread overall, the way it broke down, is that Eastern team did have a slight edge, but it was about 53-47 as far as the percentage breakdown. However, if that West Coast team was playing their second straight on the East Coast, on the Eastern time zone, they were actually over a 60% cover. And you know what that means? It's being factored into the spread. The lines maker's sharper than the public, and they're already factoring that in before you even have a chance to pluck your money down at that Vegas window. And so you got to look at it from that perspective. But what Dave just mentioned throws another wrench into the system and something we didn't look up, and because it doesn't happen often, and that's to see how these teams do on such a short week. And that has to be factored in to the equation this week's game. Now, as far as what San Francisco has done, they tried to limit the traveling, so they stayed in Ohio. They popped tent in Ohio. That's where they've stayed since their last game, so it's not quite as much of a flight and as much of a travel situation. We'll see if that plays into the situation here. And again, I want to go back to what I said earlier about why San Francisco's having success. It's all about coaching and management in both the box with the coaches upstairs and with Harbaugh making that final decision by limiting the potential for Alex Smith and his offense to screw up the game. Pass the ball early on first down. Get yourself into management second and third downs so you don't have to pass the ball much on third down. If they can continue to do that and run the football with success, they'll knock off the Baltimore Ravens. It's a lot of ifs, and we got to see how they are affected on playing such a short week and having to stay away from home while doing so.
So how do we answer those ifs? It's actually kind of simple. We talked about a lot of different numbers pertaining to the 49ers so far, but here's the magic number, strength of schedule. Number 29 this season. How do you get to be 9-1? You run the ball and play conservatively, as Scott has talked about. You work on the turnovers because that's what you can do against weak teams. What do they have to do Thursday night? They have to play a good one. You're not going to beat Baltimore by playing conservatively, by waiting for turnovers. They're not going to give them to you. Now you have to step up and make a play. And that's where we think we see the San Francisco talent. That's, yeah, it's 7-3 talent, 6-4 talent. It's not 9-1 talent. This is a different setting. I do need to clarify one thing, though, that we think does make a big difference here. They were home Sunday, so they're traveling all the way from San Francisco. The stopover in Ohio, that was when they earlier had to play back-to-back games on the road. So this is a full travel cycle for them. They lose a full day out of this week. For the first time all season, they're going to face a team that'll stand toe-to-toe with them. They're not going to be the one punching somebody in the mouth. So how do we close out our Thursday? Our holiday dessert, let's call this our pumpkin pie play of the day. We're going to look to the Ravens. We're going to lay that 3.5. We think there could be a little bit of shock factor. Ray Lewis is going to be back for Baltimore, not 100%, but just the fact that he's there adds a nice element. Frank Gore badly needed a Sunday to Sunday to get his knees rested. I don't think he's going to be that effective on a short week. So let's look for the Ravens to throw a little bit of culture shock into the 49ers and make Baltimore -3.5 our play of the day. We're going to be back on Friday with all sorts of holiday leftovers and plenty of winners on the weekend board. A lot of great games on Saturday, on Sunday. Scott, thanks for sitting in for us today. We're also going to have you back on Friday. Not a traditional Thanksgiving, though. You will not be having turkey. Could it be something a little Asian in your household?
We do a little bit of both. A little bit of turkey, a little bit of Chinese. You know, our family is made up of Panamanian, Filipino, Japanese, Chinese. We got a little bit of everything. So it's kind of unusual for a boy from Omaha to have that much different food on the table. But that's what we do when it comes to Thanksgiving. We'll have it all.
And if you're Scott's family, reminding you that he did bring donuts today, make sure when he leaves Friday, there are some leftovers coming. Good luck with the next couple of days. We'll see you Friday on Vegas Sports Day.